From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In the age of social media, self-promotion, being out there, can seem like everything lately. Facebook likes, retweets, LinkedIn connections. Society seems to say recognition, some touch of fame, equals success. But there's another way, focused on craft, skill, a job well done for its own sake, invisibly. This hour On Point, the invisibles making the world work all around us. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is that you? High impact, low profile. How do you get your satisfactions in our age of look-at-me recognition as the measure of success? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is David Zweig, writer and one-time fact-checker. There's an invisible task. His new book is Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in the Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. David Zweig, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
First surprise from me, I opened your book on the invisibles, and first line, first page is all about Led Zeppelin, the Rolling Stones, Eric Clapton, Van Halen. These are the furthest thing from invisibles. Where are we going here?
That's right. Well, all of those bands that you just named share something in common. One person, a man named Andy Johns.
Never heard of him.
Andy Johns. What did you say?
Never heard of him.
No, well, of course not. Andy Johns was a recording engineer. His job was to get the sound that the musicians were making in the studio to capture the magic on tape. And it requires a real technical expertise combined with an creative and artistic gift for knowing how to get that sound. And you can tell by the list of artists, Led Zeppelin, and excuse me, excluding the Beatles, there's a little bit of a trick at the beginning of the book. I give everyone a quiz, but it's
guess which one he wasn't here. Supporting the Beatles. Okay, the Beatles in there too, but yeah, Led Zeppelin, the Rolling Stones, Eric Clapton, Van Halen, and producing material that's since been sampled all over the place by Beastie Boys and Bjork and Eminem and you name it. All this the work of Andy Johns. And what exactly did he do?
Right. So, Andy, the samples that you're talking about are from a song called When the Levee Breaks from Led Zeppelin IV, one of the most important rock albums of, you know, the past generation. And Andy Johns, along with Jimmy Page, who was the guitar player of Led Zeppelin, but Andy Johns is the recording engineer, figured out how to get this magical, cavernous drum sound on tape. And he did something very unusual. They hung just two microphones far away from the drum kit on top of a stairwell. And it was, and this was really counterintuitive. At the time, people were using lots of microphones, placing them very close to the drum kit. So this seemed kind of revolutionary in a way, but that's how he got this incredible sound. So you have this music, whether you're talking about Zeppelin, the Stones, or some of these other artists, millions upon millions of people around the world, for cultural touchstones of a generation, people have been listening to these songs. And Andy Johns' personal stamp is on this music. He wasn't some guy just sweeping the floor in the studio. You know, this is a guy whose personal skills affect the sound that we all been listening to for so many years. And yet, of course, no one knows his name.
He is one of your invisibles. Here's that drum solo right here from the beginning of When the Levee Breaks, Led Zeppelin, 1971. And yes, Bjork can say thank you, and the Beastie Boys can say thank you, and Eminem can say thank you. And that sound, he came up with it, and he's invisible. They're as visible as could possibly be, the Rolling Stones, Eric Clapton, Led Zeppelin, and all the rest. What makes one guy want to be Mick Jagger out front, and another guy or gal end up as one of your invisibles? Important, but a quiet elite, you call them, David.
That's right. You know, Andy Johns is one of among millions out there of people I call invisibles. And the people who I focused on in particular in the book are people who are at the tops of their fields, but who do this invisible work. And as you mentioned in the beginning, I used to work as a magazine fact checker. I was an invisible. And, you know, when I was on that job, I realized, wow, the better I do my job, the more I disappear. In fact, it's only if I made a mistake that anyone would ever think of me at all. And I began to wonder, are there other jobs like this that share the same sort of inverse relationship between work and recognition? Most of us, the better we do, the more attention we get. Yet in that job as a fact checker, if I was perfect, I wasn't noticed at all. I was invisible. So I began wondering, well, are there other jobs that share the same relationship between work and recognition? And if so, what does that mean in a culture where we are told essentially that attention is going to bring us success, that attention makes you feel good? And how do these people operate? So I began on a quest to find other invisibles. I traveled around the States. I went to Europe, to Asia, meeting with these invisible workers and to try to find what are the common threads that these people share.
Give us some more examples, people, jobs, invisibles, and their work.
Well, one of the people who I met with for the book was a man named Dennis Poon. He is a structural engineer for skyscrapers. Now, if you think about, you know, these grand buildings, we tend to, if we think of them at all, we tend to think of the architect, or
or whoever it may be.
Yes, Frank Gehry and whoever, Starkitects they're called, right?
Yes, right.
But without Dennis Poon and the engineers like him, these buildings wouldn't stand. I met with Dennis at the Shanghai Tower. This is the tallest building in China, the second tallest building in the world. And I'm standing there with him. We're like 80 floors up. The wind is like whistling through, whipping my pants back and forth. Yeah. There's no walls or anything. There's teams of workers, you know, buzzing around the building. The billions of dollars invested in this project. And this is a matter of both civic and national pride. And I'm talking with Dennis, you know, how do you, where is your reward? No one notices you.
Nobody knows his name. Dennis Poon. Who ever heard? Yeah.
Exactly.
Not a star architect.
Yet incredibly important. Without him, the building wouldn't stand. What is his reward if no one knows about it? And he said to me, it's an honor. It's an honor for me to take on the responsibility of this task. And responsibility, there's a couple core traits that all invisibles share. And one of them I call savoring responsibility, that unlike most of us, or it seems to be the case that a lot of us want to kind of get away from being responsible for things, these people seem to want responsibility. They savor it, as I say. So when I asked Dennis about all that weight on his shoulders, his response was, it's an honor. So what an incredible thing that to view responsibility not as something to be burdened with, but as something to be proud of, to something to be honored with.
Responsibility as its own reward. Take us on some of the other peaks of your mountain range of invisibles here. It helps us understand where you're going. There's a structural engineer standing with you. Your pants are whipping high above Shanghai in the tallest next to building in China or the world. What else?
Yeah. So one of the other people I met with is a guy named Pete Clements, a.k.a. Plank. That's his slang nickname. And plank means guitar. It's one of the slang terms for guitar. Mm-hmm. Pete, for over the past 20 years, has been the chief guitar technician for Radiohead, one of the biggest bands in the world, one of the most respected bands in the world. Night after night, sold out concerts to 20, 30,000 people. He has to manage the band's equipment, their most precious assets, more important than the lighting rig and anything else. If the guitars don't work, there's a problem. And yet, of course, the fans at the shows, they're simply having a good time. They're enjoying the show. If everything goes off without a hitch, if Plank performs his job perfectly, he remains in the shadows. And that's exactly where he wants to be. So it's really remarkable when you think about, well, what is his motivation? When I think about Plank, you think about Dennis Poon, a woman named Julia Wilkins RE I met with, and she is one of the elite interpreters at the United Nations. Now, their job is to be this unseen, this kind of neutral conduit for diplomats from one part of the world to communicate with another. They literally, if without them, I think it's not hyperbole to say that the UN would grind to a halt. No one could communicate with
each
other.
And this is a very refined skill. You've got to be able to listen, comprehend, and turn it into another language all simultaneously.
It's remarkable. It's quite different than translating, where someone is dealing with the written word and can take their time, which is a craft in its own right, of course. But simultaneous interpretation is an extraordinary skill that requires both an innate ability, but also a lot of training. And so when you think of Julia Wilkins RE and her colleagues at the UN, when they do their job perfectly, no one ever thinks of them. You don't hear about the interpreters being talked about in the meetings. Their role is to be just this neutral conduit for one nation to communicate with another. So where is her reward? Where is Dennis Poon's reward? Where is Pete Clements when he does his job perfectly that no one thinks of him?
I suppose then the modern measure would be that they're tweeting constantly about how great their interpretation is, or how tall their building is, or how sweet their guitar for Radiohead sounds.
Right.
But they're not. You say they are actually actively ambivalent, this set, about recognition.
That's right. You know, when I mentioned that there are a number of traits that invisible share, the prime trait that they all embody is this ambivalence toward recognition. They just simply don't seek attention the way so many of us do. And the thing that's fascinating about it is, so then you begin to wonder, you know, it feels good getting recognized. It feels good when people pat you on the back. So where is their reward? And for them, the reward is in the work itself. It's the value of your work, not the volume of your praise. They recognize that that is what's going to bring the deepest and lasting reward. And you see it again and again in the book with all these different people who I met with in this really wide range of fields and industries they work in. And I chose people who are at the tops of their fields. And it's like, well, you know, how did they get there? How did they become so successful? So that's kind of this two-pronged thing that one, but a lot of research and psychology backs this up, and you see it with the invisibles themselves, that number one, people who derive their reward from the work itself, from an intrinsic reward, it's called, find far deeper and lasting rewards than people who seek extrinsic rewards. These are rewards like money and attention than they can ever provide.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the invisibles, those people, maybe top professionals, who enjoy working in a cloak of invisibility in a time when everybody's a brand builder. Unsung heroes we'd like to think in all kinds of jobs who just get it done and done very well, but are ambivalent about recognition. David Zweig's new book is Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. David Zweig joins us from New York. David, we have a lot of response here, and I want to share some of it with you because it takes me to a question. But here's Ron. He says, my wife works for the Red Cross, and through her I see there are many thousands of people who volunteer in various groups or ways to help others. Without them, largely invisible, we'd be in a deeper hole than we are. Here's Patrick. I've made numerous contributions to one would call systems development, computer, base operating systems, and so on, the kind of stuff that makes Facebook and Twitter work. Nobody thinks of that stuff. Gerald looks to spies. Okay, they're low profile until they're not. Lowe says farmers are invisibles, working 24/7 without recognition or much gratitude from the public. Here's a very public radio invisible. Jenny May Harms says the invisibles of a public radio station, the development staff raising the money, but we love what we do. She's at KOSU Radio. These are not, you're sort of focused on what you call quiet elites. These are not all elites. I mean, here's one what Marge says. I'd like to add to this list of invisibles, ladies who lunch. They're often laughed at as ditzy, but without them, there would be few who do the work of church boards, serve at food banks, read to children in school, volunteer for underserved communities, generally keep everything running without pay or recognition. Why are you looking at elites? When I read invisibles, I first thought of all kinds of people. Yes, some elites, you might say, and others doing the kind of work that you might not consider elite, but is absolutely essential to keeping everything running in this world, though they may not be very high status necessarily.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are great points. You know, I focused on people who are at the tops of their fields in the book as invisibles, mm-hmm. but merely as models, almost as something we can all relate to, but yet also aspirational. But make no mistake, we all do invisible work in different elements of our personal lives and our work lives, that the invisibles aren't an exclusive group by any stretch. The people I focused on are merely at the far end of a spectrum we all fall upon. So the people that your listeners were naming, people in the Red Cross and these systems development people, absolutely. These are invisibles and people who embody some of these invisible traits. So the people I focused on the book or at the tops of their fields because, well, hey, one, it's fun to read about people who are great at what they do and who really affect our world. And number two, I wanted to find out, is there some sort of correlation between their success and the fact of them being invisible, of their approach? And the fascinating thing is that there's a lot of research to back this up, and you can see it in their own example, that it's counterintuitive, but in fact, people who aren't tooting their own horn, in fact, can become very successful. We're told, as you're talking about, you know, the brand itself, everyone mm-hmm. needs to raise your profile or have a platform. But the fact is, and you can see it again and again in the examples of the people in the book, wow, these people became incredibly successful, achieved so much, and they got there by doing the opposite of what we're told we all need to do. How did they do it? And you find that there's a lot of research in business scholarship and elsewhere that shows that good work does get recognized. It's really encouraging and heartening to know this. And this doesn't mean that we don't all need to promote ourselves and our work at certain times and in certain circumstances. Hey, I'm here, you know, on the radio with you right now.
And you're a former fact checker, for heaven's sake.
I am. But the fact, so it's really about, in the end, it's not even about whether you're visible or not. It's really about what motivates you. And these people are motivated, I was mentioning, by these intrinsic rewards. And there's just this wealth of research to show that when that is your motivation to do good work, to see yourself as a member of a team, remember Dennis Poon saying, it's an honor. One of the things that I noticed with Dennis Poon and a number of the people I met with is that when I would ask them about themselves, invariably they would say, we. It was almost never I. And I was just struck by this semantic kind of default that they had, that here are people incredibly successful. If anyone has earned the right to say, I am doing this and I'm doing that, it's them. And yet they view themselves as a member of a team. There's Robert Elswit. You probably don't know that name.
No.
But I bet you can name five directors right off the top of your head.
Yes, I could.
But you might be hard pressed to name one cinematographer. Robert Elswit is an Academy Award-winning cinematographer. He did There Will Be Blood, the Paul Thomas Anderson movie.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
And he's worked on a number of incredibly commercially successful films as well, a part of the Bourne Identity franchise, mm-hmm. Mission Impossible. And the thing about Robert Elswit, you would think, here's this guy with an Academy Award. He's paid a lot of money. And when you see that scroll of names at the end of a film,
of course,
a lot of those people, the gaffers, the grips, they are under his charge, ultimately. If this guy was very self-effacing, very humble, his chapter I call the Art of Collaboration,
yes,
that this is a guy, again and again, these people in these different fields view themselves as members of a team, view their work as part of a larger endeavor. And amazingly, and again, it's really heartening, but that attitude, and you see, this is how these people got to the top. You think that in order to be a CEO or someone at the top of a field, that you need to have this blustery personality, you need to be tooting your own horn all the time, but you don't. And that's what these people show us again and again. And I just found it incredibly surprising and encouraging.
You know, it makes me think of the Oscars, where it's all the glittery folks who are on stage, the famous selfie that went everywhere, all over Twitter and YouTube this year. And then they've got a little 3 minutes where they talk about all the technical Oscars that were given off stage, out of sight. In a way, it's those people you're talking about. But it's a kind of philosophy lesson you're looking to give us here, maybe to help us wind down the obsession with public recognition. Look inward a little more. Look to the work itself a little more. David Zweig's new book is Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. Lots of callers for you, David. Elise is calling from Grovetown, Georgia. Hi, Elise. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you do? Are you an invisible Elise?
For the most part, yeah. I'm a veterinary technician, and I specialize in nutrition and behavior. And a lot of people don't realize that veterinarians don't spend a lot of time on the nutrition end of it. A lot of people think they just push the products that they're given, but they kind of rely heavily on their technicians, not only as a patient advocate, but to communicate with the client what their pet needs. And it's hard to get recognition that way. And for a long time, I wasn't satisfied with just being a technician. I wanted to be more. And then I realized that I might not have a doctorate, but I'm doing what these doctors can't do.
And talk about humility. You're pushing the dogs and cats out front, Elise, and making them happier and healthier.
Yeah, exactly. And making sure that the clients themselves, the owners, know exactly what's going on, because sometimes doctors are just busy. And we have a couple of doctors who refer to us to the nurses. We're not just technicians, we're nurses. And that kind of makes us more relatable to people, because they understand what a nurse does, but they don't know what a technician does.
Do you relate to the sense of satisfaction in the work itself that David's talking about here, sort of not being shackled to needing a big stage to play it out on?
I do now. Before, I didn't. When I first got into the industry, I didn't. There are more, I guess, negative times than there are positive times, but now the positives outweigh the negatives, and I've learned that I don't want to be making all the shots. I don't want to be in the public image. I just like doing what I do, and being a doctor, you can't just do what you do.
Elise has grown into it. We appreciate your call from Grovetown, Georgia, Elise. Let me get one more, if I may. Thank you, Elise. Jack in Needham, Massachusetts.
Hi, Tom. Hi. This is a great topic. I love it. I'm a software engineer, and I've been writing software all my life. My reward, as your guest says, comes from the work. I've been in Boston area startups for many years, and you know, there's nothing better than starting with a just blank sheet of paper and building something and then seeing it last. It seems like so much of what software engineers do is short-lived, at least in startups. It disappears fairly quickly. So it's very rewarding to see your own software survive in a product for years and years.
Do you really, in
doing the work.
Do you relate to these characteristics? Ambivalence to recognition, devotion to meticulousness, savoring responsibility, Jeff.
Sure, it's meticulous. And the reward is a recognition of a different sort. It's not, you know, you're not going to be walking down the red carpet, but you get known in a community of people who actually understand what you're doing, and that's very rewarding. I mean, you know, I don't think they often seek fame. Do you know John Carmack, the guy who did the graphics engines and all the Doom things, and now he's, you know, made a lot of money from that?
Maybe I should, but I do not know.
He's an amazing technical talent, and people in that area of the software world just follow his utterances, his tweets, his blogs religiously.
Even though he hasn't gone out maybe searching for it first of all. Jack, from the software realm, I appreciate your call as well. One more, and I'll bring it to you. Susan in Dunstable, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I have a comment and a question.
Yeah.
I'm married to an invisible, and what I'm hearing is pretty much right on. And my question is there some kind of a relation between the personality type of an invisible? Do they tend to be more introverted than extroverted?
And is there a comment as well, Susan, or is just your marriage is the comment itself?
Yes.
Okay, we'll take it. David, are these introverts you're talking about by nature, and therefore this is the way they roll?
You know, it's interesting. Some of the people I met with certainly come across as a bit more introverted. Many of them, in fact, are a little shy. Some of them required a lot of work for me to get them to agree to be profiled for the book because of their nature of just not wanting to be in the spotlight. But others who I met with were very gregarious, very personable people. So when we walk back and think about it again, it's really not even about whether you're visible or not. In the end, what occurred to me, you know, what I concluded about the message of these people, it's not about how much you're seen or not. It's not about whether you're an introvert or not, although many of them tend to be introverted. In the end, it's about what motivates you. And that's the sort of key piece that I realized about these people. And that's the thing that we get from them. It's this notion that so many of us feel this pressure, including myself. I talk, you know, it's funny. When my book was out on proposal, there were a number of different publishers who were interested, and I had meetings with several of them. And one of the editors I spoke with at one of the publishing houses started, you know, complaining to me, saying, yeah, my boss is telling me I need to have a Twitter account. I need to raise my profile online. I need to do be doing this, that, and the other thing. And she said, I'm an editor. My whole job is to be behind the scenes. Why are they pushing this on me? So there's this real resentment I found from talking to people and an anxiety that I think a lot of us feel. There's this pressure that we have to be constantly pushing ourselves, both if we want to become successful. This is what the, you know, the marketing gurus and stuff tell us, that you need to be doing all this stuff. And also just to feel good about yourself, that we're told that we need to be doing all this stuff. And what the book offers, I think, is this validation of, hey, you can be incredibly successful. You can be very fulfilled without following this plan, without, you know, with being able to break free from the ethos today. It's just, it gives people permission to step off the wheel. And I just found it this incredibly validating message that there can be a countercurrent to what we think is just this dominant prevailing culture that things have to be a certain way and they don't. You can be successful, you can be rewarded, and also at the same time be happy staying out of the spotlight and just concentrating on your work.
It's funny in a way that we live in a time when you have to say that. I mean, for most of history, that's just the way it was. And of course, all the philosophers said, you know, work is its own reward and all that kind of message. But today, social media is everywhere, and maybe you're right. Maybe lots of people feel some pressure to be noted there. Annette in Holmes County, Ohio. Annette, thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for speaking with me. Mm-hmm. I wanted to say that I had a dream. I had a goal. I substitute those words for work.
Okay.
Because for the last 17 years, I've spent it building my own home, which was my dream. It's a goal that has fulfilled me. I couldn't imagine trying to broadcast that on a Facebook page or blog because I'm too busy doing it.
And that has been its reward for you, Annette.
Absolutely.
But, you know, these days, you can imagine somebody, you can imagine someone these days looking to turn that into a reality TV show, Annette. I built my own home.
Absolutely. I think about that frequently in the last few years. I think about people who write books. I did this for 1 year. They take 1 year and they do something, and then they make it a band, you know, get on a bandwagon and broadcast it. No, real passion requires a lot of years. A lot
17 years on that home. You've definitely got the passion and the commitment. Annette, I appreciate your call. I mean, David, you kind of turned this whole thing around. You're kind of insinuating here that we've got a little bit of a psychosis around the need for recognition today, that, as you say, was trapped on a wheel.
Yeah, I more than insinuate that. I am saying that for sure. I mean, you know, people have always desired attention. This is not new in certain cultures and in certain circumstances. But what's different today is that to a certain degree, our communications and technology and culture that's developed, I think really has both enabled and amplified this kind of what feels like almost an instinctual desire for attention. And it's both in our work lives, where we're told, you know, we're this kind of need to CC your boss on any accomplishment you have. And this notion, you know, I was talking about that editor who told me she was told she needed to start a Twitter account. And also in our personal lives, think, as the caller noted, think about the amount that people feel like they need to share all the time online. And it feels like almost a little bit of a failure. I think we all secretly admit this when you post something on Facebook and it doesn't get a big reaction. It almost feels like a failure, that our metric of value today is attention. And what I'm trying to show is that we don't have to be this way all the time. There's nothing wrong with gaining some attention and gaining recognition. It feels good. So it's not that it's bad to want attention sometimes, but it's that this obsessive sort of focus on it, that's the problem. And these people in the book really show another way.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the invisibles, those who enjoy working in a cloak of invisibility in a time when everybody's a brand builder. We're looking at unsung heroes, all kinds of jobs that just get it done, top professionals in many cases. But I guess I'm pushing the angle that it could be in many, many kinds of jobs. David Zweig has written it up in his book, Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. He joins us from New York. What kind of work? Well, maybe piano tuner. Here's one. Terry Harper, been tuning pianos for 30 years. In this video from the Sydney Opera House, where he works in relative anonymity, he says it's hard work, but very fulfilling.
It does give me great satisfaction to listen to that, to all kinds of music in this place. And, you know, from rock to pop to whatever, if they're using a piano, I usually try and see at least one performance.
How about UN interpreter? Here's Brigitte André-Sirpearl, former chief of the French section at the UN Interpretation Service, here from a promotional video called The Interpreter, describing the challenges of her unsung job.
School of thought would say, as long as you translate the word, you know, it's okay. No, you have to make sense. It has to be coherent. It's not enough to do the translation. You know, you have to interpret and make full sentences, and you have to make sense in what you say.
And what about the person who answers the 911 call or brings your flight in safely? March 2003, Fort Worth air traffic controller Luella Hollingsworth, know that name, saved a pilot's life when she realized he was slurring his words.
Or one, Papa Mike, if you got the oxygen, try that. Just send a maintain flight over 180. November 501, Papa Mike, radio check.
501, Papa Mike.
And down he came safely. Unsung hero, you bet she is. All kinds of response online going lots of directions here, David Zweig. I mean, Tammy says, how about executive assistants, especially those who support major CEOs and others like the president? Paige will take it right down home. She says, I'm a stay-at-home mother. I feel my work is mostly invisible, but it's the most important work in the world. Paul writes to us on Twitter, speaking of invisibles, the excellent team behind Tom Ashbrook is a fantastic example. Amen to that. That is very true. I mean, we've got all kinds of front men, and you use that phrase, who really are riding on waves of invisibles, David.
Yeah, I mean, there are just layers upon layers of invisibility. You know, I'm looking through the glass right now at the engineer here in New York, you know, that if something goes wrong, then we would know about her. But if everything goes perfectly, we're never going to think of these behind-the-scenes
people. And I'm doing
people.
The same thing here in Boston. Five right. people, great people on the other side of the glass right. doing all kinds of things to make this work.
And, you know, and the amazing thing is about the people who I met with for the book is that there's a wealth of research that I cite in the book, and I know I mentioned a few items here during the show, whether, you know, business scholarship, psychology. But what really kind of drives the point home is simply seeing the work that they do, the impact they have on our lives. One of the people I met with was a guy named Jim Harding, who is an expert in a part of environmental design called wayfinding. And he designs the signs and systems in airports, hospitals, campuses to get you where you need to go. When you check into an airport and then you go through security, you grab a sandwich, you go to the bathroom, you get to your gate. These places are incredibly complicated. You probably never think of the signs unless you get lost. Then you're frustrated. But no one ever puts a thank you in the comment box yeah. at an airport saying, thanks so much, I got to where I needed to go. You know, and Jim Harding, for him, he said the reward is in the work. Invisibility itself is a mark of honor. So what I hope from the book that people get is that you will never enter an airport the same way again after reading this book. You will never go to a concert the same way again after reading this book. You will never see a skyscraper quite the same way again. So there's all these different fields that affect what we see, smell, and experience in our world that are run by these people who we never think of. So if nothing else, beyond all the messages about how to become successful and how to be fulfilled, if nothing else, it's a window into the people who are running our world, but yet who we never think of.
Let's go to Paul, West Bend. Paul, thanks for calling. You're on the air. Hello, Paul. Are you there, my friend?
Hi. I think power load dispatchers that sit in command centers around the United States that monitor the power grid system, and they have to react to catastrophic events that may happen to prevent the collapse of the power grid. It's a 24/7, 365 position, and they're controlling billions of dollars worth of power generation and the transmission grid, along with the various energy energy plants that are creating power, either with natural gas or thermal or you name it.
Power load dispatcher, deciding where the power goes on the grid as hurricanes come in, or you name it. And without that, we've got a lot of people in the dark or maybe overloaded. Seems like a great example. Paul, thank you for calling. Let me get one more. Rhonda in New Haven, Connecticut. Rhonda, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks. Great topic. I'm a professional flutist, and I love what I'm hearing about this book. My problem is, you know, I grew up with the fluffy dream of thinking that I will get to perform. That's what I do.
Sure.
That I would get to perform by people coming to me, you know.
So are you an invisible or are you a visible, Rhonda? I mean, you're performing, so that's visible.
I'm very visible, but here's mm-hmm. Yeah, here's the catch, is that I don't get to do what I do unless I, you know, it's unless you promote yourself, unless people, you know, like that saying, okay, you think you have the golden egg, but nobody knows you have the golden egg. So I find it a real conflict with my art that I have to promote myself because I don't want to do that. Somebody else should do that, you know, on my behalf, you know, but when you have to really, it's really in your own hands and you don't get to practice your profession unless people invite you to do so.
That's interesting, because
kind of the opposite.
Yeah, you must have many of the traits of an invisible, that is, devotion to meticulousness, a sense of responsibility for the work. But if you, these days, David, help us here, unless Rhonda promotes herself, I mean, we had the wonderful violinist Hilary Hahn on not long ago. Now, she's a great violinist in her own right. Rhonda, no doubt, a great flutist. Hilary Hahn promotes herself pretty effectively on Twitter, though, and it all flows together. You know, these days, maybe people who would like to be invisibles feel they can't entirely.
Now, I'm so glad that this caller called in. You know, in the end, as I keep saying, it's really not even about whether you're visible or not. It's about what motivates you. If you're looking toward a path toward success and a path toward being fulfilled, like your caller, in the end, it doesn't even matter whether you're a behind-the-scenes person or someone up front. The CEO, there are plenty of CEOs, and I talk about this in the book, that exhibit all of the traits of an invisible, even though they're running the corporation. You think about a star quarterback who's silently studying game film night after night leading up to Sunday. You think about the overnight sensation pop star who actually had been playing dive bars for a decade leading up to that point. That we all do invisible work at different times, and we all need to promote ourselves at different times. What the people in the book show is that it's really about what motivates you, and that if you lock into this mentality that these people have, and again, you know, the people in the book are really at the far end of a spectrum we all are on. And myself, I'm a visible. I'm a writer. I'm no longer a fact checker. And although I've maintained my fact checker's mentality, I actually corrected someone on another radio show and said, I'm sorry.
Contain yourself, man.
Right. But I'm happy to have my name on the cover of my book. So there's nothing wrong with being a visible or not. There's nothing wrong with promoting ourselves at times. It's about what motivates you, and it's about what's going to bring you the greatest reward. And again, what's amazing is these people show in the book time and again, this is what brought them success. By not promoting themselves, that's how they became successful.
Yeah, but Rhonda's
good
point
work
is
gets
a
recognized.
Yeah, Rhonda's point is a little different, though, and I want to stick with it for a second because she's expressing ambivalence about self-promotion, but feels that she has to be pulled into the vortex of self-promotion because society has changed. There's an expectation that you will be putting your name out there. And if you're not, well, maybe those people who are going to book flutists won't be booking you.
Yeah, I mean, there are a few jobs where your role is to be out front. And if you want to be a performer, then sure, you need, unless you have a full apparatus behind you, then you need to do some promotion.
I mean, flutist isn't exactly Eric Clapton. Yeah, you know,
but
you're a performer, but
right. When you're someone who's really out front, if that's your role, then there's a certain amount of work that you need to do. But what the evidence shows, and you see it time and again from the people in the book and a lot of research shows, is that people who spend more time, I bet the caller will find more success and has found her success by practicing and being really, really great at what she does than by spending more and more time promoting ourselves.
Yeah,
that
I
what
don't
I
know.
Argue, it's I, not I, that we don't need to promote, it's mm-hmm. that our balance is out of kilter, that we're spending far too much time on promotion, and that the people who found success, interestingly, spend far less time promoting themselves. It doesn't mean they do zero, but it's far less of an emphasis on that and far more time spent on their work, which both is more rewarding.
I hear you. I'm a little afraid your message is jumping the shark there on the reality that some people face right there. But I hear you. Rhonda, thank you very much for raising that dilemma. Doug in Norfolk, Virginia. Doug, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you and the rest of your team for taking my call.
Thank you so much. Great. Put your hands in the air for that team.
Exactly. I'm an audiovisual technician, so I sit behind the scenes wearing black at mostly corporate events. So when you go to an event and you don't know that I'm there, it means I did my job perfectly.
Man in black, but not Johnny Cash here. You're behind the screen in a way, but making it work.
Exactly. So, you know, when the microphones aren't feeding back on stage, then I'm doing great. And I just wanted to say thank you for David, and I can't wait to pick up his book.
Thank you for your work, Doug. Man in Black, Jay in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Jay, thank you for calling. You're on the air. Hello.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that one of the most visible, invisible people out there is the mailman and the trash man, and I'm a trash man. I don't see most of my customers. I don't know what they look like, but I stop at their house every week.
Yes.
And they have no clue what I look like.
And without you, things would be a mess in a hurry.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it'll pile up fast.
So are you, what do you feel about that, Jay? Do you want a few more shout-outs from the people whose trash you clear off every week?
Oh, no, that's the whole thing is I do get letters and stuff like that around Christmas time, and they'll leave me a couple extra bucks or something to say thank you to the driver. But I don't need them to know my name. They don't have to know. They just need to know I'm there. And it's a comforting thing because everyone puts their trash out, and then it's just magically gone when they come home from work.
Jay, I'm so glad you take the story. I'm so glad you stretch this right there to exactly that point. Jay, the trash man in Fayetteville, who we need. And, yeah, you may call it invisible, but you can't live without it. I appreciate your call, Jay. James in Savannah, Georgia. James, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What do you see?
I feel like the last caller. It's 330 million people in America, and I bet I can't name 5,000 names of individuals I would recognize.
Mm-hmm.
The vast majority of America is just doing their job and taking care of their families, and they're not recognized.
What kind of work do you do, James? Visible, invisible?
I build nuclear power plants, and I hope nobody ever hears my name.
Yes, I'm right there with you. A great point. And yes, please do that work very well when you do it. We don't want those to go wrong. I mean, David, there is a powerful perspective on this as well. You know, there you are in New York talking about everybody working their Twitter handle and their Facebook and their LinkedIn. But, you know, surely James is right in Savannah. 330 million people in this country, maybe more. And can we name more than 5,000 names among them? I mean, most people live and work invisibly every day. I guess you could say even there, people are tweeting, they're developing some kind of followership, and maybe they feel infected with the most be recognized virus right now too. But James is saying, come on, most of us are invisible.
Well, that's exactly right. And that's, I think, part of the problem, that there's this almost an illusion of the ability. It's one of the scholars I spoke with talked about, he likened it to playing the lottery, this notion of, yes, there's always the potential to become famous, you know, on the internet. And I tell a story about someone who ended up gaining 1 million followers on Twitter, 1 million people. And she was no happier. She had this line where she said, it didn't make her teeth any brighter. It didn't bring about any more success. So this notion that, of course, all of us, for the most part, are doing invisible work. But yet, a lot of us are operating under this atmosphere where we have to constantly promote ourselves, where we think we have to constantly promote ourselves, and where we think that that's going to be the path both to becoming more successful and also the path to feeling good. But it's like an addict with drugs that you're only as happy as that last Facebook post that got a lot of likes on it. It's never enough. If you're seeking happiness through gaining attention, man, you are never going to get there. And I think we all know this on an intuitive kind of internal level, but this message really gets drowned out in the larger culture today. And that's what I show with these people in the book, that these are people who are really some of the most satisfied people among us. And, you know, how did they get there? What are they doing that's bringing them so much satisfaction, even though their work is just permanently behind the scenes? And that's what I found so inspiring about it.
You feel a special depth of satisfaction, a kind of calm in the people who don't have to jump onto social media and trumpet every second thing they do.
That's right. It gives you permission to just step off the wheel. And that's what if there's one message of the book that people can come away with is you don't have to do this. We all need to do it at certain times, you know, in certain circumstances. But by and large, look at these people who've become incredibly successful, have achieved so much, and they've got there by being members of a team, by viewing themselves as part of a larger enterprise, by saying we instead of I. So they're very fulfilled. So this just this sort of magical hybrid between these traits that really is the opposite of what we're told we need to do to feel good about ourselves, the opposite of what we're told we need to do in order to get ahead professionally. Yet here are these people time and again who are showing us, hey, there's another way.
Here you are on a microphone broadcasting. How do you go back to the farm after you've seen Paris? Going back to fact-checking, David?
No, but writing is solitary work. I spent 2 years working on this book and probably about, you know, 2 weeks or 2 months promoting it. That feels like a healthy balance.
True that. David Zweig's new book is Invisibles, The Power of Anonymous Work in an Age of Relentless Self-Promotion. He joined us from New York. David Zweig, good luck with it. Thanks so much for coming out with your message.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, thanks so much for being with us today. On Point is produced by a whole lot of great people. Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Julie Jopp, Sam Gail Rosen, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, James Ross, Dean Russell, with help from Abigail Collins, Gretel Kaufman, Sarah Wanger. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman, and I, at the tail end, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.